The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the podcast that digests technology and spits it out into something tasty for the discerning palate. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we've got a cracking show for you this week. Last week was a busy one in UK social media land, with Time Warner's $850 million purchase of British-based social media network Bebo, and Natasha Kaplinsky kicking off her MySpace debut with the Channel 5 newscasts. Meanwhile, Rockstar's appeal over the BBFC's rating was overturned, and the Enfant Terrible's Manhunt video game will be released with an 18 rating. But that's old news, or actually it's kind of current news, but old news. And this is a new media podcast, and to discuss new things are Bobby Johnson and Charles Arthur. What's new with you both this week?
I'm considering buying a new laptop, but I think only after the tax year.
And Bobby, anything new in
Well,
in your
we did just buy an EPC for our household, but the most exciting thing going on in my life at the minute is shelving. I've become a shelving addict. I have colour-coordinated bookcases. I'm a bit of a geek.
I've seen that. And
so are you going to organise the books by alphabetical or by the colour of the spine?
By the colour of the spine. Yeah.
He's got the orange row, the white row.
It looks really lovely.
It's really rather disturbing.
Let's move on, please.
But yes, thank you very much. Well, I hope you're ready to dig deeply into the underbelly of technology. On today's podcast, we'll be talking media. Music media with the chief executive of the British Music Rights Organisation and music icon, Fergal Sharkey, and BBC TV media on the iPlayer with the BBC's Anthony Rose. We've also got an elevator pitch from Locomatrix, a company that aims to get kids playing games outdoors, plus the news and more from you on the blogs. Hold on to your headphones and welcome to Tech Weekly. Fergal Sharkey has always been a powerful force in musical history. First as the lead singer of The Undertones, then during his successful solo career, and now as the chief executive of British Music Rights. As a group, the BMR represents the UK's musical content, from the source to the listener, via all of the available publishing and distribution pathways. And that's where the technology comes in. Last Friday, Fergal spoke at the ISP Association's Internet Industry Awards and delivered a powerful speech that talked around the government's proposed three strikes policy to illegal music downloading. We welcome him into the pod to grill him about the details. Welcome, Fergal.
Hello, and thank you.
Brilliant. Well, first of all, I'd like you to sort of give us a baseline. Can you tell me what the dominant financial model in the current music publishing industry is?
Well, music publishers have always had a licensing model, i.e., it's distinct from record companies in that record companies have always dealt in the hard product itself, whether wax cylinders or CDs. Music publishers was always about giving a right and granting a right to someone else to make music in some way or other. And that goes right back to early coffee shops in Victorian London, all the way through now to the recent deals we've been doing with people like MySpace, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And it's suddenly become quite a varied platform, isn't it? Because you no longer have the very linear from the creator to, you know, pressing it onto a plate to sending it out to radio station.
It's one of the things, and I have a lot of actually empathy for record companies at this point in time. It's a much easier step for publishers to take into the new cutting edge environment that we all now live in, because their basic trade has always been, oh, you want to use a piece of music? Well, we'll do a deal with you for you making use of that music. For record companies, that's a much bigger philosophical step to be taken, where ultimately, perhaps they will become content providers as opposed to having lots of little vans shuttling up and down motorways with bits of plastic in the back of them.
Of course, now as the various pathways are available, we're starting to get the recent government proposals of the three strikes, you're out policy for ISPs.
I have to kind of clarify something here. The government hasn't actually proposed three strikes, and you're right, and are possibly maybe never even going to do that. Mm-hmm. I think someone took potentially two very different stories and bolted them together. Government made it very clear to everybody, we very shortly will now begin consulting on what structure government intervention might take. And either way, should there not be some sort of resolution by April of 2009, then we will put something on the statute book and create some sort of law.
But one of the things you're advocating or you tried to compel the ISPs to think about was not to take away someone's broadband because they've illegally downloaded music.
It's not necessarily because they illegally downloaded music. For me, one of the challenges we face, and certainly I think the first step in the process, is actually trying to help those people find a way to monetize it and get them into a system where they can actually get access to music in a way that they're comfortable with, on a platform that they're comfortable with, but in a way that actually compensates the songwriters and the musicians and the composers for the work that they do.
Fergal, we got some questions that were put on the technology blog by some of our users, so okay. I'd like to put them to you. The first one comes from Simon Something, because you, in an interview with the Register, you talked about, you know, there's fair trade coffee, there's fair trade this.
Sure.
Where's fair trade bloody music? And his question was, if you look at the fair trade model for produce, to a large part it's about buying direct from the producer and cutting out the middlemen who seek to drive down supplier prices.
Yep.
Would you really welcome that model being applied to music?
I think it's extraordinary that people can go to somewhere like Charing Cross Road, into any of those instrument shops, go home with a couple of boxes of kit and start being creative. Brilliant. So for some creators, some musicians, some songwriters, doing exactly that model will be the one they will pursue. And I think that as society, we have an obligation to support that choice for any young creator. But equally, I think we also have an obligation to support the choice of a creator who goes, I want to assign my songwriting rights for the next 5 years to that music publisher, because actually I think he can do a better job at negotiating with the BBC or Sky Television or somebody else and get me a better deal.
Next one comes from James Chekhov. In what way is the music sharing now going on different from music taping and sharing that went on in the 70s, the 90s? Because isn't music piracy great promotion? It used to be that you had people who were taping, you know, every 45 single of some garage band. And if you shut down the freedom of ISPs in what feels like a sort of online phone tapping, you're also opening the doors for all sorts of other industries to cry foul and use the same expedient. He says, I'm more concerned with internet freedom than with Phil Collins' ability to squeeze every intellectual property penny from In the Air Tonight.
We see it's ironic that people always squeeze this down to people invariably in the music industry who they perceive own endless mansions in the countryside and spend most of their life driving around in a limousine with a jacuzzi in the back. The reality is, as I've now been trying to point out to a number of people, according to the Musicians Union, 80% of musicians in this country will make less than £10,000 this year. And that number increases to 95% of songwriters and composers who this year will receive less than £15,000 in income and in royalty payments. Now, again, using that analogy that it's about the Phil Collinses of this world, it's unfair, it's unjustified, and personally I think it's a bit of a cheap shot for the vast majority of young songwriters, composers, and musicians out there who, the reality is, barely managed to scrape a living.
Okay, now, but surely the point is that that 80%, you know, 95% figure hasn't really changed since the days of home taping is killing music.
It has changed, because the reality is what digital technology has established. And I'll put my, you know, I think everybody needs to think back to the 1970s when the cassette was the thing to have. The reality was you could only make 2 or 3 copies of it, and just by the sheer process of degradation from one copy to the next, it was unlistenable very quickly. Of course, in the modern world we live in, you can take one digital copy, you can replicate that millions of times, it will sound exactly as good as the first one, and more importantly, you've now got a global distribution mechanism available to every single person that's got access to the internet. That's a very big different thing from someone making a copy and giving it to their mate at school or something. They're not on the same scale and they're not actually comparable at all.
How would you recommend, or what options do you think there are for the music industry to work with ISPs as one of those pipelines?
Well, the industry itself, I have to say, quietly in the background, has been doing an extraordinary amount of work over the last couple of months. And one of the things we're looking at in detail right now is probably 4 or 5 very, very different models. And some of that might be, for example, you pay an extra couple of pounds a month and you're entitled to X amount of downloads, to the possibility, and it is nothing more than a discussion right now, to, for example, a much-as-you-can-eat permanently switched on downloading service. Would that interest the consumer? The bit that we have to try and potentially work out right now is what actually would be the value of that and how much would you charge the consumer for that? Because we've never done this before. There's no existing models. So you can't sit down and go, well, I know a loaf of bread's going to cost me 99p and a pint of milk's going to be 50 pence or whatever it is. We just don't know.
I've got to say, when Napster, the original Napster, was in its sort of full flight and millions of tracks were being downloaded through that, I always felt surprised that the record labels didn't go and talk to it and say, why don't we get a slice for every track that is downloaded? Because they could track them.
I'm not by any means trying to defend record companies here, but you have to bear in mind that this thing came along and just dropped in their lap. And that for record companies, again, the challenge is that they're having to turn their backs on what actually was their core business for 100 years. Mm. Because for 100 years, we have sold people bits of plastic that they physically owned. And suddenly all of that's transforming. And the bigger the company gets, the bigger a challenge that becomes. It's a big thing to do and a big thing to demand.
There was a bit of a precedent, wasn't there, though, in terms of changing how one charges when player pianos came in and they had to think of the entire concept of mechanical copyright, didn't they?
The thing, every single major growth period throughout the music industry's history was actually driven by technology. There may be a key in there somewhere.
How do you feel about the future? I mean, where do you...
Fantastically optimistic. Because the reality is, are people going to stop being creative and wanting to make music? Well, absolutely not. Yeah, and I've absolutely no doubt that that fantastic combination of hormone-ridden teenage frustration and a couple of electric guitars in the back room of a pub will keep rock and roll going for some time to come. At the other end of the scale, are people suddenly going to stop disliking music, not want to consume it, not want to interact with it and enjoy it? Simply not going to happen. And in fact, there's more demand now for music than there's ever been at any point in history. The bit that we need to fix and that we need to do a bit of work on is the bit in the middle, and that's called the music industry that just joins both those ends together.
Brilliant. Thank you very, very much, Fergal Shirky. If you've been inspired by this debate and want to contribute to the ongoing discussion, then please do let us know what you think on the Tech Weekly blog, which is blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology. So, Bobby, what's been going on in technology news this week?
AOL's announced that it's made a deal to acquire social networking website Bebo for $850 million. The American giant said it wanted to supercharge revenues at the site, which is based in London and San Francisco and has around 11 million users in the UK. In the wake of the controversy over ad targeting company Form, Tim Berners-Lee has said that internet users should be protected from being tracked by their service providers. So Tim's comments came as Yahoo said it would start using some elements of the semantic web on its search index, potentially bringing us closer to his vision of the next generation of the web. Manhunt 2 has finally been granted a certificate for release. 9 months after its first refusal rating by the British censors, developer Rockstar Games won an appeal and will be releasing an edited version of the game with an 18 rating. And finally, outgoing eBay boss Meg Whitman has announced her new job, helping to run John McCain's bid to become President of the United States. The senator from Arizona is said to have convinced Whitman to join his campaign by offering her a full collection of Smurf figurines and a mint-condition Muppets poster signed by Jim Henson.
Bobby, that was a terrible joke.
Yeah.
You're not allowed. That's awful. You're not allowed to be my stand-up comedy writer, ever. Anyway, let's get back to the task at hand, technology. Charles, can you break down the Bebo numbers?
Yeah, the Bebo numbers are interesting. If we look at social network acquisitions, and we just do a quick run through, cast your mind back to July 2005, News Corp bought MySpace for $580 million. At the time, it had between 18 and 22 million users. That's about between $26 and $32 per user. August of 2007, High Media bought Photolog. Yes, I know you didn't notice it, but that's a rather cheap $9 per user. In October, Microsoft bought a chunk of Facebook for $240 million. That worked out to $300 per user. But if we look at the Bebo buy, that's a much more reasonable $21.25. Thank you to Silicon Alley Insider for the analysis. But it's starting to look like Microsoft really overbought for Facebook, and that it's much more reasonable to reckon that people are worth around about $20.
I think it's interesting because everyone's been jumping in. You know, everyone's got a different opinion on AOL buying Bebo. Most of them aren't very positive. Looking at the numbers is a interesting way to look at it. But you can also look at the way Bebo makes money. And it's got a much more interesting and developed way of delivering content to users. It really partners up with media companies in a way that Facebook is starting to explore, that MySpace didn't at the time that Murdoch took it over. So what you're looking at really, I think, is they want to buy into this. And if you look at the way things like Kate Modern have gone in the UK, I think AOL saying, that's a good market. Can we do it somewhere else?
I think as well, it's something to look at as the different age groups that we're talking about here as well, because MySpace, teenage market, Facebook, older market, that's when you've actually got a broader market as well. Whereas what AOL have done is they've bought a market that is definitely emerging, because Bebo tends to slant towards the younger user. So they may be looking to how they can develop this in the future and how they can move it forward.
And Microsoft's rather high price for a tiny slice of Facebook was also about stopping Google buying a slice of Facebook. They were desperate to get a win in a period of some turmoil for the company. So, you know, they're really worried about the internet and getting webby.
Charles, I wanted to touch on something that we didn't talk about in the news, and this is the Free Our Data campaign that you've been running in the Guardian Tech section?
That's right. For the past 2 years, we've been running the Free Our Data campaign, the object of which is to get the government to make available the raw data, the raw impersonal data, that is, that it collects, make it available for free so that web developers can create mashups. The sort of data we're talking about here is things like mapping data, weather data, and companies' house data. And there was a very significant study carried out by two Cambridge economists and a Cambridge professor of law, which was published with the budget last week. And this actually did a very detailed degree-level economics analysis of, well, would this be a good idea? And what this study says is that, yes, giving this data away for free will generate benefits. For the Ordnance Survey, the calculations in the report suggest a potential net social benefit of more than £150 million. And that's just for the Ordnance Survey. And a report by the Office of Fair Trading at the end of 2006 suggested that there's £500 million of potential value to the national economy that's being lost by not making this data more available.
In sum, good, bad?
Fantastic for the Free Our Data campaign. All you have to do is to read it. And the conclusion that you reach is, yeah, giving this raw data away will actually stimulate more interesting companies, which will do interesting mashups with the data, and we'll all benefit.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That's all for now from the news. But you can read these stories and more on the website, which is guardian.co.uk/technology. The BBC's iPlayer media channel may have been dogged by bad reviews and technological problems since it first launched, but the internet's been all aglow since the channel announced that the iPlayer service will be available on the Apple iPhone and on the iPod Touch. Bobby, what's the story here?
It's a really long and interesting story because it was announced years ago by Greg Dyke, the former Director General, but only actually launched last summer. Now, that was in a form that allowed you to download programmes, and it didn't prove very popular because the restrictions were quite heavy. However, at Christmas, they launched a streaming version, which has gone like a bomb. People really enjoy that. Now, a couple of weeks ago, they developed that a bit further and developed a system where you could watch it over the iPhone or the iPod Touch. Now, that had the interesting sideline of also allowing a loophole that let people plug straight into the system and download unrestricted programs if they wanted to. This proved fairly controversial, but the story's ongoing there. Now, the result of all of that really is that some people are pretty happy that they can kind of hack around it and get to the programs they want, but other people are still interested in why the BBC picks one thing over another. So we spoke to Anthony Rose, who's basically the head of the iPlayer team, on the day that they launched the iPhone client, and we asked him, why did the BBC pick Apple and the iPhone over and above any other system they might be developing?
Well, the short answer is it hit the right notes in terms of having a big screen, being able to nicely browse the iPlayer website, and consuming a data feed that we could supply, namely H.264, and that our programming looks fantastic on it. Separately, I think, you know, people have thought that the BBC is in bed with Microsoft and so on, and this is, of course, complete nonsense. We're looking to embrace every platform that we can. I think it's fantastic we could do it on an Apple device. The problem really is with DRM, where the solutions available in the marketplace are limited, and there are no broadcasters or third-party companies that offer their downloads on Apple devices using Apple DRM other than going through iTunes and so on.
The projects you've got looking into new DRM solutions and open source DRM solutions, are the iPlayer team involved in that, or are you focused on just getting iPlayer going?
No, it's all, there's a combination of things that need to be done, you know, for this week, for next month, for 3 months' time, and for 6 months' time, and absolutely in discussion with a number of DRM manufacturers to look at next-gen DRM, which will make iPlayer work for downloads, not just on Apple and Linux, but in fact on various handsets and so on as well. So I think we're now reaching a point where there is a critical mass of interest in enough companies in some other DRMs, and they're beginning to get there. They're not there yet, but I think later this year we'll actually see an explosion in not only streaming but now downloadable content on other devices, thanks to the maturity of other DRMs.
We've seen a kind of an acceleration in iPlayer since the launch of the downloadable programs last year. Now we've got the online streaming stuff coming on very thick and fast. You know, this iteration of it is only a short period after the public launch of the iPlayer streaming service. So are we seeing now, is this cranking up? Are you starting to get the sausage machine to do all the things you want it to do?
Absolutely, yes. So one of the reasons that the iPlayer was quite long being baked, in a sense, is that most of the work is beneath the surface. So you look at the website, you go, oh, there are a few programs, you browse around. And what you don't notice is there is programming coming in 400 hours a week, that's 70 hours a day. And as things finish on TV, they get pulled in on tape and off air. And there's a huge production system behind it that also is now able to be tweaked and enhanced to provide it in different formats. So, you know, there was a year or whatever in the making, and now we're trying every month to get some new release out.
It seems quite clear to an outside observer, looking at the sheer amount of traffic that's going through the streaming services, that that's where the real demand is. How does the streaming versus downloadable argument pan out in the long run?
I think there's been criticism of the download service, and people have said, well, people stream as 8 times as much as they download. But I think that that's not an accurate description. So when you stream, you usually sample. I'll try a few seconds here, a few minutes there. When you download, you probably are going to watch more of the program. So downloading gives you a higher def version. In due course, we'll have HD downloads. And at the moment, the downloading is sort of a little bit isolated. But over the coming months, we want to do things like create an online library. So on your mobile phone, you can add something to your online library, and your computer at home wakes up and downloads the HD version. So when you get home, you've got the HD one ready to watch. So those are the sort of propositions that are enabled by a download system when it's tightly coupled to the website. And we look forward to doing that class of thing later this year.
So you said you're now looking at monthly release schedules. Could you give us any idea of what we might see in the near future?
I think around the end of this month, we look forward to iPlayer on another device, but I'm not going to pre-announce that yet. And then in the May timeframe, we look forward to an all-new iPlayer website, which I've just seen the design for, and it looks fantastic. And it'll do all sorts of cool things, like remembering the last program you watched and automatically resuming it and things like that.
One last thing. You didn't join the team too long ago, and things have only really recently started to happen in a really fast way. And I understand there was lots of back-end work going on, but there was also a lot of political trouble with iPlayer over the years. You know, the hiring of new people in to get stuff done, does that mean the BBC has overcome its political problems with this kind of project?
When the BBC one day said, how about putting into, you know, our programming on the internet, that took a long time to arrange. So all of the development of the production system, the rights negotiations, public value test took a long time. The good news is when I came along, it was, you know, in late beta stage. And so now we've seen the result of all of that hard work and are able, thanks to the platform we have, to now come up with cool new things every month or two.
So, Bobby, have they fallen for the Apple hype? Is that what this is all about?
You know, the iPhone has the most web-like browser of any mobile device. So it's very easy for them to push into the iPhone and the iPod. I think the really interesting development here, though, is that they're pushing these unrestricted streams to mobile because that's the only way to do it because the DRM doesn't exist. So what they're doing is kind of security through obscurity way of dealing with it is really just a workaround around the tricky systems that everyone's been pissed off with. You know, and this means that people on Linux, people on OS X can download these things on the sly. And I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, over the coming months where they move. If they say, right, now we're going to start locking this stuff down, or whether they say, okay, you know, we'll accept that there's an attrition rate of people who will be downloading using this service in a way that we didn't intend it. But, you know, when you're looking at it all, What they're saying is we are more prepared to try more things to get this to work for users. We're going to start giving users what they want, I think is something we should all be happy about.
I was looking at our TV license, which arrived over the weekend, and that was talking about that you have to have a TV license if you're watching at the same time as the thing's being broadcast. This is not quite that, is it? But I'm wondering whether the whole iPlayer idea is actually the BBC looking towards a future when people won't necessarily be watching at the same time, whether this is actually part of a very stealthy idea about what if everyone's watching on mobiles. I mean, are we going to have TV licenses for our mobiles? You know, how's the context on that, do you think?
I think we're going to see Ofcom and the government and you know, all the different departments having to think about this as time goes forward. I honestly don't believe, from talking to the various people I know around the BBC, I honestly don't believe there's a kind of 20-year plan going on. I think they're really scrabbling to work out what the future is. And that's been one of the problems why they've been beaten down by the government so much recently.
Thank you very much, Bobby. And also thank you to Anthony Rose from the iPlayer team. Jemima may be away, but I threw myself in front of the lift and I've opened up those doors. And so it's time to welcome another unwitting startup into our elevator of dreams. Let's hear from this week's victim, who I grilled in the lift at last weekend's bar camp in Brighton.
Welcome to Elevator Pitch.
Ground floor. Please mind the doors.
Right, I'm Richard Varman. I'm the founder of Locomatrix, outdoor gaming organisation.
Going up.
What's your background?
I was originally a biologist, but then went very quickly through truck driving and being a musician into computery things. I worked with a chap called Heinz Wolf for 12 years, first for Medical Research Council, and then at Brunel University, where we were mainly doing work for European Space Agency, before I moved down to Brighton, where I was web designer and developer before inventing Locomatrix.
First floor.
Explain your business to my mum.
It's a way of playing games outdoors using a mobile phone and GPS unit. GPS is about tracking where you are. Very similar to playing indoor computer games at a console, but taking it outdoors.
How many full-time staff do you employ?
Rather than employing people, we're using the best of people in Brighton. So we're using two other companies, ClearLeft, are doing all the website usability side, and Future Platforms are doing all the mobile side. And then I'm bringing in other people for things like PR and business development.
Second floor.
How are you funded?
Me, my wife, and my mum. We thought we would need more money to take it to the stage. I mean, we've launched, but we're at a soft launch at this stage. We have paid for it entirely ourselves now. We're going to start looking for money soon.
How many users do you have now, and what's your target in 12 months?
We've got about, I think, 300-400 people that have actually seen it and have played with the system. And I would say we could get 10,000 by the end of the year.
Third floor.
What's the weirdest business experience you've had thus far?
Approaching, can't remember the guy's name now, the one of the ministers, was saying, evangelising about how children should be outdoors playing games, what can we do to get them out? And I sent him an email and one of his men said, we get these sorts of things coming in every day. I'm sending you a prospectus for NHS buying services. I sent another one back. He said, was that helpful? And I sent one back saying, no, it wasn't very helpful. This is about ideas. This is something that you want to do, unless it's spin. Do you really want to do it? Are you interested? Because we have answers. Didn't hear from him again.
Are you the next big thing?
Yes. Or possibly next but one.
Fifth floor. Doors opening.
Right, so while this was playing, we were all looking at one another a little bit skeptical, thinking, is this like geocaching? You know, what about the old racket and ball type of thing? And I'm wondering, because there has been a real push, particularly by the Conservatives, to, you know, they're saying, yes, children need to go outside, obesity, blah, 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 blah. Do you think this kind of thing will achieve those standards, will sort of move it forward?
Listen, I've got a brilliant idea for a startup company. We'll hide all the kids' mobiles outside somewhere in the fields and they have to run around and find as many as they can in the shortest possible time.
Understanding ringtones.
I can see them potentially selling it to a theme park, because Let's remember, not many kids have GPS devices out there. But, you know, if you were at Euro Disney or something and everyone was dished out one of these things and you played this game, that might be a way forward. It kind of seems to have limited market appeal to me. But
the problem is that schools, for example, and county councils, which would be the sort of the educational side of it, probably won't be able to afford it, and I'm not sure that they would go for the idea of kids doing this with their mobiles. The Euro Disney idea, well, Euro Disney's a big place, and you'd have to be pretty sure about the age of the children who are doing it and how much you trust them to wander off on their own.
Well, so, I also think, actually, that I think a lot of the theme parks are working on that kind of stuff themselves. They don't want to buy it in because they think there's some money to be made from licensing it out to someone else in the long run.
So. Also remember, this isn't just about mobile phones, it's about GPS technology. So if, for example, like Nesta and Future Lab in the past have run these things with PDAs using this kind of thing for the educational purposes. So there are possibilities, and I think, you know, what you suggest with the theme park, that idea with museums and those kinds of foundations, or in education, there is a potential for using this and getting people to do the location-based types of things.
There's certainly potential for it, but it's just the question of A, cost, B, effectiveness, C, do you trust your kids running off in this way where you're not quite sure where the hell they are? Yeah, it need a lot of really careful design.
Thank you both very much, and also thank you very much to Richard Varman from Locomatrix. It's time now to hear from you and what's been going on in the blogs. First up, technology. Charles, what's happening?
There's been a lot of action, of course. The issues of Windows and Linux on the Asus PC was a big one. But I was looking at the stat from Apple, which said that 100,000 copies of the iPhone developer kits have been downloaded in just 4 days after it was announced. I'm very interested by the iPhone SDK because back in the end of 2004, I was talking to Apple's marketing manager saying, you know, this iPod thing, if you really wanted it to be a success, I mean, not that it wasn't a success then what you need to do is to sort of turn it into a platform so people can write software for it. And she said, yeah, we sort of talk about that from time to time, but we haven't, yeah, we're not going to do that yet. But the SDK, which has been so wished for by people, has really got people very excited. And so I asked people, well, what would you like to see on the iPhone? And Ethan said, solitaire would be useful for something to do in long meetings.
Really thinking outside the box. Well, speaking of games, over on the games blog, Greg, who is a relatively new dad for the second time, he's been talking about the potential for gaming with kids, specifically focusing on Steven Spielberg's EA collaboration, which was unveiled last week. It's called Boom Blocks, which is a Wii game that features brain-twisting challenges and 30 wacky characters. And we threw this out to the games blog community, and Granny Core did have something quite prescient to say about the role of Steven Spielberg in this process. He said, I'm not aware of Spielberg being a game designer, so this is fundamentally a block-based puzzle game with his name stuck on it. What next? Francis Ford Coppola's Keyboard Hero.
Very good. Ooh. We're going to need a bigger Wii. I wanted to pick up one from... it was from one of the kind of mudslinging Linux versus Windows threads.
We never had those, did we?
That, you know, that we're all fairly used to. But I really wanted to pick it up because it showed a rare moment of self-restraint on the internet. So regular commenter Fred Two left a long and very detailed explanation of something and then immediately followed it up by saying, oh God, please delete my previous post. I've bored myself to tears. Fred, good on you. We didn't delete it, by the way.
Well, the dialogue continues and we want you to contribute, so please do get yourselves over to the blogs at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/digital-content/games to get your two penneth in.
I'm James Randerson, and on the latest Science Weekly podcast, it's a science and literature special as we discuss science, fiction and lab lit with our special guest, science writer and biologist, Dr. Jennifer Roan. Also in the show...
It's time for science to grab us by the scruff of the neck and shake us from our pointless torpor.
Biology or Beowulf? Maths or media studies? Comedian Robin Ince gives us his thoughts on the merits of science versus the arts. Plus,
then the paper came out of that, and it was called Scrotal Asymmetry in Man and in Ancient Sculpture.
We go behind the scenes at the Ig Nobel Awards to hear about the links between country music and suicide, the dangers of sword swallowing, and scrotal asymmetry. It's all on the new Science Weekly at guardian.co.uk/audio.
So So, Charles, apart from basking in the glory of the free our data win, what else is in the tech section this Thursday?
We will be looking at what the government should be doing next in the free our data campaign. But we'll also be looking at two services that let you shop online without having to give over your bank details. Those security experts are warning that it's not the panacea that it appears. We have an interview with Clay Shirky, whose new book, Here Comes Everybody, looks at the new collective tools that are being made available to people. Got an article about 3D x-rays that are far more useful than previous ones. Andrew Brown is looking at the mysteries of spam, Vic Keegan on how to encourage the creative industries, and Michael Cross on fear in the public sector. And I've been trying out a virtual keyboard that creates a little keyboard on the desk created by laser.
And I actually talk about PMUG, which is my new favorite thing, a passively multiplayer online game.
Passively, not passive-aggressive multiplayer.
Oh, no.
Was that you? I got an email over the weekend saying, you have been signed up to the PMUG distribution list.
That was me. Oh, it's fascinating. Anyway, that's in Thursday as well. Next week's Tech Weekly will be available on Tuesday, as usual, when we're going to have exclusive content from that Clay Shirky interview. We here at Guardian Towers will work diligently over the bank holiday Easter weekend for your listening pleasure. It is, of course, the least we can do to keep you happy. So be prepared to download it from guardian.co.uk/audio on Tuesday as usual, or register for the podcast to get it sent to your computer or MP3 player for free. Thanks very much, of course, to Bobby, Charles and Fergal, to our producer Scott, to Anthony Rose at the BBC, and to you for listening. I'm Alex Kwiatkowski. See you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.